If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret, searching for the sound. This is the Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
I've Got a Hole Where My Heart Should Be from Canada's own The Sheepdogs off their new record, Changing Colors, due out February 2nd, 2018. Their sound is a familiar one, and this is a band that wears their influence on their sleeves and don't really care. I've been following the career of The Sheepdogs for quite some time, and we've shared many laughs along the way. That's why I was excited to get bassist Ryan Gullen on the phone to talk about their sixth studio album and everything going on with them. The conversation started when I asked Ryan about this latest record having a more stripped down and authentic approach.
You know, at the time when we made that self-titled record and we did it in Nashville and worked with Pat Carney, it was kind of like, you know, a situation where Pat Carney's a friend and Black Keys were a very big band and he really wanted to do the record and we entrusted in that. The funny thing about our band is we've been a band for like 8 years at that point and we produced, self-produced multiple records and a lot of people got to know us through Learn and Burn and through, you know, I Don't Know being a single and things like that. And so to go into that situation, it was kind of what made the most sense at the time. But after that kind of whirlwind that was our lives for a couple of years there with, you know, Rolling Stone stuff and with, you know, obviously all the attention being put on us, it was kind of what made sense at the time. But then after that, with the, you know, future nostalgia and now with Changing Colors, it's been kind of like, getting back and taking hold of things and, you know, looking not just as like, you know, what makes sense for the moment, but kind of like what makes sense for, you know, the long term. And I think that every record you make is kind of a capture of the moment in time, right? Like it's your, the material, the songs, the, you know, who you are as a musician, where you are as a person, all are going to influence that. And I think, you know, this record, and maybe the last one too, maybe a lesser extent, is just a, basically just kind of a snapshot of where we're at. And I think not necessarily wanting to redo things we've done in the past, but getting back to, like, you know, the nature of how we used to make records, where we would hang out and play music and just have, you know, work things out and spend time doing that. And then the product of that being the record. And I think that's a little bit more what this was about. I mean, this record, we spent, you know, a good 7-8 months just hanging out, working on music and having fun and like trying ideas. And then if it didn't work out, leaving it and coming back to it like 3 months later, and having that amount of time, I think maybe develop that sound a little bit more. Whereas, you know, other records you've done very fast and done very quickly in, you know, just working in a studio and just trying to do it over a couple weeks. Whereas this one, we really wanted to spend time. So that probably, I mean, if not to get like existential or something like that, but that probably is more of a sample of kind of who we are as a collective. It may be similar to like a Learn and Burn, where, I mean, that record was recorded over a long period of time because we had to record it ourselves because we couldn't actually even afford to record a record at a studio at that point. So we had to just learn how to record, and we worked on it for months and months and months. So that's probably why it's coming back to that sound, and it allowed us opportunities to experiment and try different things. And
yeah, and that isn't to say even Future Nostalgia doesn't have, you know, the Sheepdog sound. I just find whether it's the big riffs or the songs or the topics of the songs, it's a real good feel good record from top to bottom. And so for me, it was like, yeah, it is like 2011 or 2012 all over again. It just felt that way. It just feels that way. The flow, everything about it really feels like you're back in that old pocket. And it probably speaks to working on it collectively. I mean, that's great.
For sure. And I think what was exciting about this record too, in the same way that we, you know, kind of all collectively worked on it, is, you know, our new guitarist, who's been with us for over 2 years now, but Jim Boskill, and he brings to the table. And it's our first time, you know, we played together for a year and a half, 2 years, but our first time actually sitting down and composing and creating together. It was the first opportunity to do that. And it was a very fun experience because of, you know, he's an amazing guitar player, but he could basically play any instrument that has strings fantastically. So having that, you know, being able to add strings, add pedal steel, add banjo, mandolin, those kinds of things, and do that in a way where we can have fun. And it's not like one of us trying to figure out how to play one of those instruments or asking someone to come and do it. It's someone within the fold that could just kind of add those flourishes to things and make songs more interesting or just add different, you know, color. I mean, that's the whole thing about the changing colors, is it's like not necessarily like a changing of the guard or anything like that. It's the idea of, like, we always talk about color being adding color to a record, you know, adding different parts and pieces that kind of, you know, color the basic structure of the song. And having Jim involved in that allowed us to do that. And that's a little bit more in the realm of what we did back when we were making, for example, like a Learn and Burn.
Right, right. Well, Born a Restless Man obviously is one of those songs that you probably wouldn't have done without Jim in the fold, right? I mean, that's as bluegrass.
I mean, we recorded that song on a tape machine in his living room as well. So
wow.
We tried to track that one in the studio, and it was sounding good, but it didn't feel, I mean, it sounds cliche, but it didn't feel organic enough. And so we just were like, why don't we go drink a whole bunch of beers and track this in Jim's living room in Port Hope, Ontario. And so we brought a tape machine out, and we just did it like that. And it really changed like the vibe of it, because we were like kind of half cut. And, you know, very much of a lot of those kind of old records like that, where guys were like half cut and just hanging out, having beers and recording music. And it was in a living room. And that's kind of what we did.
That's the thing. Like, things come through in this record, whether it's Seamus's keyboard playing or whatever. It just feels like it feels fresh again. And it doesn't lack the Sheepdog riffs. And I know you're the bass player, and all of the songs have a very typical, you know, groove and what we've come to know you. But You Gotta Be a Man is like riff mania. Kiss the Brass Ring again is those big riffs. Those big riffs that we all know, I don't want to say grew up on, but we all know, and we all know that have come from you guys. Is it exciting? Like, is it exciting to write these new songs together and then, you know, go play them on the road? Is it still fun to do that?
Oh, God. I mean, you're kind of, you know, half musicians are always like, they'd almost rather always be in the studio, and the other half almost just want to play on the road. And we're very much like half, you know, if you're having fun making music and we're getting excited about it, the first thing we want to do is play that for other people. Because I mean, one of the most gratifying things is when you create something like an album and then you go out and you play that on the road. And when you play it on the road, you see people reacting to that the same way that you maybe reacted when like you and brought a riff and like, what do you guys think of this? They're like, oh man, that's sick. Like, yeah, that's awesome. And that's kind of where it goes from there. And so I think it's always exciting. I mean, the challenge is when you do a record, you have to kind of wait to put it out. And it's so hard to not just play new music for your whole set. Like, you want to obviously play the songs that people want to hear and you want to play the old songs, but it's hard to like hold off on like sharing those things with people because you're so excited about it. And I think we always make music in the sense that we want to just make, we're not trying to make a song just to like be on the radio. We're not trying to make a song just to like be successful. We want to just make the songs that we like. We want to get excited like we are when you hear a new record. And you're like, oh man, this is such a cool song. It's such a great record. We want to have that excitement when we're making it. So then it's just exciting to want to share that with people who like, basically, you know, like the same music that we do. And so it's like, here's our take on this sort of thing.
It's a party record. I mean, that's the thing, right? I mean, you could put it on and it could be the soundtrack to your Saturday night of fun, whether it is the slow burns like the Big Nowhere or Ain't I Cool, or even the big numbers like Saturday Night or Born Restless Man. You know, there are songs that get you up and dancing, but there are also songs that, you know, are the slow burns that you guys are also known for. So it kind of, it runs the gamut and could be a great soundtrack to your Saturday night.
For sure. I mean, we always jokingly say, people ask us what our genre is, but we jokingly say like music you could have a barbecue to, or like, right. You know, cause it's like, you know, like basically that exactly. I mean, you don't want to make, you know, there's obviously records I like that are just like all riffs, and there's also records I like that are super chill. And I think that we try to ride the fine line between those two things. Cause I think they can be connected in a way that, like you said, it could still just be a soundtrack to your night, but it also could just be, you know, a song that's good for when you're hanging out, just chilling, or, you know, whatever, just sitting on a couch listening to a record alone or things like that too.
So you've been, you know, you've been friends with Ewan for a while now, and you've seen this thing grow organically. I mean, you guys were like, what, 11 when you met or something, or 12? I mean, it's been a while.
Yeah. It was grade 7 or grade 6. I think it was grade 7. So however you all are, I guess like 12, 11 or 12, something like that.
And I can only imagine that you've been joined at the hip or the Walkman ever since. Everything is, you know, bands go through this where, you know, people aren't getting along, or, you know, people come and go from the band. But really the three of you, you and Ryan and Sam, you guys have been together for a while, right? And is this where you thought you'd be all those years ago?
I mean, it's hard to say. We were a bunch of like young kids just playing music together. I think that it's like we've been a band since, you know, we started playing together in 2004. So, you know, it's been almost 14 years. So that's right. Yeah. I'm better at, you know, I'm not so great at the
math. You're better at playing than math. Yeah, I got it.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I think it's funny because, I mean, I always say that like being in a band is kind of being like a sexless polyamorous relationship, where it's like, you know, you have such a different relationship with those people than you would any of your other friends. You spend so much time together, you're like, you know, your career and your livelihood is based on the things you do together, but also in the end you are friends, and we are all still friends. We still hang out like all the time. Like, we go out and do things when it's not related to the band, and you know, we're around each other, which is a lot different than I think a lot of other bands, and maybe that comes from how we've all known each other for a really long time. I think that when we started the band, we, you know, every time you start a band, you have like, you're like 18, 19 years old. You have grandiose ideas of, you know, we're going to be the biggest band or whatever, or maybe not. But I mean, you know, you're obviously just having fun doing what you're doing and learning to, you know, play together and things like that. But I think after all these years, it totally is. I mean, our end goal with everything is that we just wanted to make music a career. We just wanted to have music be that, you know, what we're doing and how we're playing the bills, and we can just spend months making a record and put it out and people are excited about it. And, you know, sometimes it's easy to lose sight of that at times because you're always just kind of thinking like, you know, what's next, or what are we going to do, or what's the next show, or what's the next, you know, plan for an album. And that's some, you know, a trap that a lot of people get caught in. But in the end, it's like, it was never about trying to be the biggest band in the world. It was like, this is what we love to do, and let's make this what we do. And so the fact that we can do that now is totally weird. I mean, I think at the time I would have never guessed that it was gone as far as it did, only because we were, the basis of creating this band was not let's become the biggest band in the world or something like that. It was just like, we were just friends playing music. So maybe that we tempered our expectations a little bit better than some. And so as a result, but I mean, had you told me that I was going to be playing in a band like this when I met you and in you know, our zone band when we both played clarinet, absolutely not. But you know, that's so many years ago now.
Right.
But it's cool. It's one of those things that, you know, you create something with your friends that has an impact on people, you know, in some way or another all around the world, and you're able to make that what you do for a living. Like that's just so cool. That's what makes it such a cool thing.
Do you think that, and I know there can't be any regrets, and I know that it was huge at the time, and I remember how excited I personally was for you guys, because, you know, I've been there. We talked when I was in a former life back in the day. And do you think that whole Rolling Stone, Atlantic Records thing, I mean, obviously it was a huge learning experience, but did it sidetrack you in any way from where you thought you'd be? Or was it just, you know, so positive in every way?
I mean, I think there's like a positive and a negative side to anything like that. I think that at the time when that happened, you know, we've been a band for 7 years. We toured across the country in the States and things like that, and we're just like losing money. And I think at the time, I mean, the misconception about that contest is that it wasn't something that we entered. It was something that I actually got a phone call from Rolling Stone magazine out of nowhere. And they were like, hey, we really like your band. Do you want to be part of this thing? Which is crazy when you live in Saskatchewan. It was the dead of winter and I was at work driving around. I was driving around for work and I had to like pull over and answer this call. So, I mean, I think the situation was that we were at almost a breaking point where, I mean, I said, we always wanted to, our end goal was always to make this a career. But at a certain point, like, you're like, I don't know what else we can do. Because, you know, maybe we just need to transition into, like, we play every once in a while and we pursue other things, you know, because at a certain point, you're just not making money. It's very difficult. And I mean, I meet tons of bands that are in that situation. I totally get it. It's not. And so when we, you know, got involved with that Rolling Stone thing, it was like, why the hell not? Like, if this is the way that we can get attention to our music and then, you know, people like it. I mean, there's always those people that were into our music, but it was never pushed out into the mainstream. I mean, the other side of it is there was obviously certain things that went along with it. I mean, people definitely associate us with that. And I think that associate us with some sort of contest, and that it was just this overnight thing where we were suddenly like forced on people and got popular because of a contest.
But, right. No, that's, you know, not the
like
case at all.
Overnight success. No, there's really no overnight success. It's always, you know, people doing that. So, I mean, there are things about it that I think we've needed to try to work a little bit harder to prove our legitimacy as a band. And I think that our way of doing that is going out and playing really good shows, continuing to put out records. I mean, it would have been very easy if that was the last thing we did and then we never did anything again. But, you know, the essence of what we did in that whole thing was it was a vessel for us to promote our music, not a way to, like, get rich, because we certainly didn't, and it was not. it was a whole thing, but it was a really neat experience. I mean, we met lots of cool people, and we like got an opportunity to put, you know, at what was basically, I mean, we play music that's, you know, of an era that is not modern, and so to be able to do things like be on the radio and be on TV, and for people to do that, because, you know, nowadays it's a little bit easier to discover bands that, you know, with streaming, one of the strengths of streaming is that you can listen to Led Zeppelin and then they're going to be like, you know, if you like this, you'll might be like Greta Van Fleet. And like, that's, that connection was a little bit more difficult to make back then. And I think it gave us an opportunity to push a type of music that was not, you know, whatever was on the radio at that time. I mean, like Nickelback or whatever, because we never would have been on the radio because of that. We never would have gotten the thing. And then when we go out and play these shows and see, you know, tons of people that exist all over the world that are into the same music we are, we always said, like, there's got to be people out there to like it. So I think to answer your question. I think that there are things about being involved in that that maybe you could sort of regret, but how could we totally regret an opportunity that was weird and whatever, but breathe new life into something we were so incredibly passionate about, but we're kind of banging our heads against the wall to get it out there. And as a result, I mean, I hope we're always going to be associated with that contest. It doesn't matter, like 20 years down the line, probably still, but I feel like we're just going to continue doing our thing and we're not going to be entering any more contests. We're just going to continue doing it, like making records, playing great shows, going out and like growing things that way. And we just utilize an opportunity that came to us to
do that.
So,
well, you got to play Australia with John Fogerty. I mean, how sick is that? I mean,
it's pretty nerve wracking when you just like, you know, I grew up riding around like rural Saskatchewan in my dad's car, right, listening to that on like cassette. So when you're standing on stage and you look over your shoulder and John Fogerty is standing there like with a big like shitting grin on his face, like watching you, it's pretty like nerve wracking. But it was a pretty neat experience. I mean, we've had numerous experiences like that where we've kind of like met our idols, and it's just very strange to be on some, not like similar, but a contemporary level with them, in the sense that you're like talking about music with John Fogerty, or like, you know, Paul Rogers is one, like,
right,
he just reached out and liked a band and we did some stuff with him, and, you know, meeting like Crosby and Nash. It's like, it's just so weird when you get those opportunities. It just doesn't even seem real, but it's also kind of funny because you build up such an idea of what these people are like based on like their music and like how, you know, prolific these people are and what they've done, and then you meet them and it's like, oh yeah, they're just a normal, you know, just kind of a grandpa kind of guy that happens to have written like 60 songs you love.
Right. Let's get back to the record, because, you know, I do want to give it its proper due, because I am being sincere when I say that it does capture the authentic sound and so much more, I think, than the sophomore release, and certainly the nostalgia record. You guys do these things, these 2-minute things, whether it's Cherry's Jubilee or HMS Buffalo or Esprit de Corps, that are just these small, fun little jams. Are they, do they come through, do they happen organically, or is it something that you guys say, we're gonna do this little, like, how do those little things come together? I'm curious about that.
Well, it really depends on the situation. I mean, we've always been a fan of, obviously, like Abbey Road and like Chicago and a few other bands that have done medleys, and sometimes they're like a collection of songs that maybe have been laying around that have never really been finished, but could kind of flow together. And then other times we've actually sat down and, like, you know, figured out the idea of these, let's put together a little suite. I mean, a lot of times there's some, like, for example, in this record has like kind of a running theme and kind of like is a little bit of a journey, in the sense that's intentionally kind of made to be a piece of music, not just a bunch of little odds and ends. But in a situation like, you know, Cherry's Jubilee was actually just a kind of a little thing we were just kind of figuring out and adding little bits to, and it became kind of what it is. And it wasn't like, okay, now we need to make this into a whole big song. It's like, oh, why don't we just make a cool album track that the first like minute 40 has just a weird instrumental, and then it's got singing in it. It's like, you know, you don't have to make everything doesn't have to be a single. So, you know, in, like I was saying, when we're making this record and kind of just hanging out and screwing around, that's kind of what we went for. We just kind of you know, hung out and tried different things and put together the track listing based on kind of what we ended up with.
It's kind of weird, the eclectic nature of the radio stations, and it probably speaks to radio and your sound as a whole, but, you know, you can be played on the number one alternative radio station in the country, and at the same time, down the hall, the number one classic rock station in the country is also playing your music. I mean, that's kind of weird, no? I mean, you don't think about that when you're making the record. You guys are just making, do you even think about singles and what's going to sound good on the radio at this point, or are you just, you're just making records?
I think for the most part, we're just making records. I mean, radio's funny in that there's times when radio is really like fired up about something, and there's another time where they've just, you know, all collectively decided they're really into whatever the song is at the time. And so anything that's kind of similar to that. And so everything we do, we never really bank on like, this has got to get on the radio, because we've learned over the years that sometimes it's going to hit on radio and sometimes it's not. And radio has been very good to us and obviously really helped with our career and getting our music out there. So, I mean, we're conscious of it. I think we want to make, you know, shorter kind of like, not popular, but like catchy, like singly types of songs, that because we want to service like our audience that, you know, it's, I mean, it's more about the audience. We want to like, you know, people, guy that's like swinging a hammer on the job site and hears our song and he's like, oh man, this is great. I'm going to go drink some beers with this record later today, or, you know, whatever, like whoever is listening. But then also, you know, we're conscious of the fact that we're making albums, we're creating albums. And it's right. Funny with, again, like back to the streaming thing. We're going back to, you know, obviously there's singles and things that people listen to one song or create playlists, but there's also this thing where people discover your band and then they go, oh man, there's this whole record, and they add that whole record, and then they're like, oh, they have like this many more records. And so the idea of doing a 17 song record is not, you know, about, it's like, here's a whole bunch of other things that you might like if you discover the band. And that's also something to take into consideration, but it's, you know, it's not really, you know, complicated, and we're not like having business meetings and conference calls about what we're going to do to market, you know, how the marketability of this record is. It's like, let's create a record and then see what we come up with and go from there. And if that means we push it to radio, then we push it to radio. If that means we, you know, maybe just make some weird videos and, you know, promote it online, that's what we do. And that's kind of how we've always got it and how we continue to do it. Cause you don't kind of want to bank on just being one type of band or whatever.
Totally. Totally. And I know that, your manager and the management company of that represents you is totally supportive in that way. And certainly the record label too. I mean, you are, you know, you're probably within certain boundaries, allowed to do whatever you want. I would imagine they trust you at this point to make good music, and other people will figure out a way to market you and sell your records and whatever else. Right.
Totally. Yeah. I think that, you know, we're fortunate enough that we were a band long enough before any of this stuff happened that, you know, we kind of already knew who we were, so we didn't need to be shaped or told how we should do things. And there's times when you know, they obviously come to you and you listen to what people have to say, because, you know, people know what's going on, the climate of things. And there's also, you know, with this record, we were left to our own devices and we just set up shop at a studio for, you know, off and on for 6-8 months kind of thing, and just kind of worked away. And then, you know, I mean, the label and the management didn't hear our record until it was about at least 3/4 of the way done. And we invited them into the studio and played them stuff. And it's just, you know, we have been afforded that opportunity now. And it's great. I mean, it's a way better way to work than obviously having someone, you know, leaning over your shoulder, like making comments. You know, that's not the way to work. And I think that's not the way we'd want to work.
Right, right. No song on the record tracks in over 4:30. So there are lots of hits and lots of things here for people to either play on the radio or play on their iPhone or just play from the Hi-Fi Center at home. Before I let you go, I do want to talk about the live thing. And I remember when I talked to you guys, I would say 2011 or 2012, whatever, Ewan said, you know, we really like the kind of music that you listen to, Ira, but for us, it's about playing the songs and not necessarily jamming them out so that they're these 15-minute epic pieces necessarily. Are you guys still, you know, I haven't seen you guys live for a while, and I apologize, but is that still, you know, are you still rocking out, you know, a 2-hour set with, you know, 25 songs or whatever? Is that still the goal?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's a time and a place for jamming. We definitely like to do that. But we, you know, you want to fit as much stuff into your set that people want to hear. And you want to like, you know, you don't want to kind of sit in one thing. It's like, you know, obviously we love music that involves jamming and things like that. But we kind of like a lot of the songs and things like that will take a different shape live than they do on the record, and they will involve maybe a little bit more of a jam or taking some solo sections or drawing it out. And I think we probably do a little bit more of that now than we did in the past. But also, you know, on a record, nothing's over. I think the longest is actually 4:20, which is intentional as a kind of a joke, but the whole thing is is, you know, a record exists as a record, and it's like you don't draw it out, and then maybe you do draw it out a little bit more live. So I'd say we probably do a little bit more of that than we would have maybe in 2011, you know, just
experience like too.
Experimenting a way to color it, and songs completely change in some ways when you play them a bazillion times live, and you try to like change it up a little bit and add different like flavors to it and things like that. But we do also just love a good rock tune, a good song that's got verses and choruses and solos and maybe a little bit of a breakdown thing, but then it's just like, that's the song, and then like we'll move on to something again. So I think we're mindful of kind of riding that line for sure. I mean, we played Mountain Jam and we had to do a super long set, and we definitely jammed more than we normally would. But then, you know, when we played other festivals and things like that, or like just a live show, you know, you want to play a bunch of different songs people want to hear. It's like no matter what songs you end up playing, there's always a song that somebody is going to later like comment or say to you later, oh, why didn't you do that one? So, and you know, considering this is our sixth record now, you know, there's a lot of songs, so we try to fit those in. So, you know, there's kind of a line you ride between both those things.
Totally. You're going out on the road. Looks like it is, looks like management's got you on the road for at least February and March, which is so cool. You're going to dip down to the United States, to a couple of places, Minnesota and Chicago and Detroit, which is all great markets for you, I would imagine. And then really you are, you know, you're doing Canada from coast to coast, which is so great. Thanks so much for this. I know the record doesn't come out for a bit, but we're totally psyched, and we were really excited to hear it. I'm really psyched about the sound. I am going to demand a pair of tickets for your March 2nd date in Toronto when I send this around, and hopefully we'll catch up. But thanks for doing this. And you know, it's been a while, and we've been watching you guys and listening to you guys, but it's great to connect again. And thanks so much for the record. And keep on doing what you're doing, dude. It's appreciated from at least one guy, and I'm sure from a lot more.
Thanks so much, John. I really appreciate all the support over the years.
Yeah, continued success, and please give my best to you. And my kids, by the way, when I told them that I was talking to the Sheepdogs, they were like, oh, man, we know the Sheepdogs. They do the song on Tim and Sid. And I'm like, really? That's a really weird way to know the Sheepdogs, but... All right, I guess whatever works, right?
You have no idea how much all over the world that people are like, play the Tim and Sid theme song. It's so funny. And that's like a song that Ewan recorded in his bedroom in Saskatoon like so long ago, like long before they were on TV. I think they were just a podcast. Or no, I think they were maybe just on, they were on like the radio in Toronto or something like that. Like, it's so funny how that's continued. I mean, obviously great, but that's so funny that would be, your kids obviously love sports talk radio or talk TV.
They love sports. And, you know, they unfortunately don't listen to the music that dad listens to, cause it's obviously not cool, but, they knew the Sheepdogs because Tim and Sid, thank you guys for this. thank you for the song.
Funny. That's so great.
So thanks for doing this, man. Really appreciate it. And we'll see you in March for sure. All right.
All right. Cool, man. Talk to you. Bye.
I truly do enjoy talking to Ryan and all the Sheepdog dudes for that matter. They are a throwback in their sound and also their approach. Definitely blue collar types that love the music they write and play, and that genuine approach comes through in everything they do. If you've never heard of the Sheepdogs, you can check them out on all the music streaming services or at their website, thesheepdogs.com. If you have, well, then you already know. You'll want to check out their touring schedule and be sure to see them when they hit your town.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love and you, their fans. For more, visit thesoundpodcast.com.